Life was lousy enough without bad-tempered cell block mates to make it worse. In the center of the field was stuff I recognized from various athletic practices, going all the way back to peewee football and hockey. There was a double line of what looked like wooden railroad ties. There were big cloth bags filled with round bulges that could only be balls. There was a line of poles wrapped in burlap. On top of each was a crudely painted scowling face. Empisarian tackling dummies, no doubt. There were ropes with rings on the ends hanging from a T-bar and a wide board on high sawhorses with a square of hay on one side. Also, a wicker basket filled with what looked like axe handles. I didn't care for the look of those. Coach Harkness had put us through drills some might consider sadistic, but whacking each other with sticks? No. I got to the front of the crowd as we reached the part of the running track directly across the field from the VIP box. Here I pulled even with Iota, who was running with his head back, his chest puffed out, and his hands pumping at his sides. All he needed was a couple of hand weights to look like any middle-aged, getting-in-shape guy from my neighborhood. Oh, and maybe a tracksuit.
"Want a race?" I asked.
"What? So that bitch Petra and the rest of 'em can bet on who wins?"
He jerked a thumb at the well-dressed whole people relaxing with their refreshing drinks. They had been joined by a couple of new ones. It was almost a cocktail party, by God. The group was flanked by a pair of night soldiers.
"Ain't we got enough to worry about without that?"
"I guess so."
"Where the fuck are you really from, Charlie? You're no Uli."
I was spared answering by the sight of Hamey quitting the track. He plodded toward the various clumps of practice gear, with his head lowered and his thin chest heaving. Between the wicker basket of fighting sticks, I didn't know what else they could be, and the tackling dummies with their scowling plate faces, there were some benches and a table covered with pottery cups. Small, like demitasses. Hamey took one, drained it, put it back on the table, then sat with his forearms on his thighs and his head down. The table was guarded, or perhaps minded, by a night soldier, who looked at Hamey but made no move to hit him.
"Don't try that,"
I puffed.
"Or they'll whip you until you bleed."
"How does he get away with it?"
"Because they know he can't do this shit, that's why. He's Mr. Useless, ain't he? But he's whole, and without him we're back down to 30.
"I don't see how... I mean, once the fair one starts, assuming it ever does, how can they expect him to, you know, fight?"
"They don't," I said, and I detected a strange note in his voice.
It could have been sympathy, or maybe I mean fellow feeling. It wasn't that he liked Hamey, it was that he liked the situation we were in less.
"Don't you ever lose your breath, kitty? One more time around and I'll be sitting on the bench with Useless and they can whack me with their sticks all they want."
I thought of telling him I'd played a lot of sports, but then he might ask me what kind, and I didn't even know what sport had been played on this big green tiddlywink.
"I kept in shape, at least until I came here.
And you can call me Charlie instead of Kitty, okay? Kitty's what they call us."
"Charlie it is."
I jerked his thumb at Hamey. Picture of dejection as he sat on the bench.
"That poor sucker's just a warm body. Cannon fodder."
Only he didn't say sucker, and he didn't say cannon fodder. That was just how my mind translated whatever idiom he had used.
"They like seeing one match decided fast."
Like number one against number 16 in the NCAA big dance, I thought. We were coming around to the VIP box again, and this time it was my turn to jerk my thumb at the well-dressed whole people who were watching us. When they weren't talking to each other, that was, because you could tell whatever they were chatting about was more important to them than the ragged slobs puffing and running below. We were just an excuse for getting together, like the guys that used to watch football practice back home. Behind us, the others were strung out, and a couple of guys, Double and a guy named Yano, had joined Hamey on the benches.
"How many of them are there?"
"What?"
Iota was now puffing, too. I still had my wind.
"Eldon's subjects?"
He gave subjects a little emphasis, as if putting it in quotation marks.
Dunno. 20. Maybe 30. Maybe a few more. The bitch queens it over him because she's Flight Killer's favorite.
Petra?
Yeah, her.
And that's it? Before he could reply, my old frenemy Aaron strode out of a walkway under the VIP box, waving his limber stick like a conductor about to start an orchestra on its first number.
In,
he called.
Everybody, in.
Iota jogged toward the equipment in the center of the field, and I joined him. Most of the prisoners were puffing and blowing. Jaya and Eris were bending over, hands on knees, getting their breath back. Then they joined the others at the table with the little cups on it. I tossed one back. It was mostly water, but there was something sour in it that had a kick. I still had my breath, but after drinking that little cup, I felt like I had more of it. Counting Aaron, there were now 5 night soldiers on the field, standing in a semicircle in front of us. 2 more were bodyguarding the VIPs. The ones watching from the parapets were easy to count because of their bright blue auras. 12. That meant 19 in all, which I thought was just about the number that had chased me in radar as we ran for the outer gate. 20 when I added in Kellen, who either wasn't here or was watching from one of the parapets. Was that all of them? If so, the prisoners actually outnumbered the guards. I didn't want to ask I, because Aaron appeared to be watching me.
Good run,
said Stukes.
Better than sex, said Fremmy.
Except for with you, said Stukes.
Yes,
Fremmy agreed.
I do give good sex.
I reached for another cup, and one of our guards pointed his stick at me.
Nah, nah. One to a customer, kitty.
Except one to a customer, of course, wasn't what he said. 2. Next came playtime, which was, on the whole, less brutal than football practice. Until the end, that was. First came the balls. There were 16 of them in 3 bags. They looked like beach balls, but were sheathed in a silvery substance that weighted them down. For all I knew, it was silver. I could see my distorted reflection in the side of mine. Dirty face, dirty hair. I decided I wasn't going to wash my hair, no matter how grotty it felt. I didn't think I was the true prince, the one come to save us. I couldn't even save myself, but I had no wish to be singled out. I had seen the palace's torture chamber and had no desire to be a guest there. We formed 2 lines of 15. Hamey was the odd man out, and one of the guards used his limber stick to command him to toss the 16th ball up and down, which Hamey did in a lackadaisical fashion. He was still out of breath from his walk up the inclined corridor and his one partial turn around the track. He saw me looking at him and gave me a smile, but the eyes above it were desolate. He might as well have had "I'll be the first one to go" tattooed on his forehead. The rest of us threw the weighted balls, 5 pounds or so, back and forth. There wasn't much to it, just an arms and upper body warm-up, but many of my fellow prisoners clearly hadn't been athletically inclined in their old lives, because there were a lot of fumbles. I found myself wondering if most had been the equivalent of white-collar workers in the place they called the Citadel before the overthrow of the butterfly monarchy. Little unintended pun there. Some were in good shape, and a few had moves. I was one. Eris was another. Tom and Amit were 2 more, but the rest were pretty clumsy. Coach Harkness would have called them glue foots, never glue feet. Fremmy and Stukes were glue foots. So were Jaya and Double. Dommy had size, but he also had that cough. Then there was Hamey, who was, as Iota said, useless. I was partnered with Iota. He tossed a series of soft lobs, shot putting our ball off the heel of his hand, so I did the same. We were told to take a step back after each pair of throws. After 10 minutes or so of doing this, we were ordered back to the track for another run. Hamie tried his best, but soon slowed to a walk. I was jogging this time, basically lazing along. Amit caught up to me easily, although his bow-legged stride caused him to rock side to side like a tugboat in a moderate swell. As we passed the VIPs, he swerved and bumped me again, only this time it wasn't really a bump, but a good old-fashioned shoulder check. I wasn't expecting it, and went sprawling. Jaya tripped over me and went to her knees with a grunt. The others swerved around us. We had finally captured the full attention of the swells in the box. They were looking at Jaya and me, pointing and laughing the way Andy, Birdie, and I might have laughed at some slapstick comedy routine in a movie. I helped Jaya up. One of her elbows was bleeding. I asked if she was okay. She said she was, then ran on as one of the night soldiers approached with his limber stick raised.
No touching, kitty. Na na na.
I raised a hand, partly to show I understood, mostly to ward off a blow of the limber stick if he decided to launch one at my face. The night soldier retreated a step. I caught up with Amit.
Why'd you do that?
His answer was one I could have heard from any of the stone-brained would-be alpha dogs I'd played sports with over the years, and there are plenty of them. If you've played, especially in high school, you know. Those are the guys who end up hanging by the fence at practice in their 20s or 30s, building beer guts and talking about their glory days.
Felt like it.
Which meant Amit needed a lesson. If he didn't get one, the bumping and pushing and tripping would never stop. After a single circuit of the track, we were sent to the rings and told to do pull-ups. Half of my fellows could do 5, 6 or 7 could do 1 or 2. I did a dozen, then stupidly decided to show off.
Watch this,
I told I and Hamie. I pulled myself up again and skinned the cat, legs over my head, a perfect 360 revolution. I had barely landed when I was whipped across the small of the back and hard. First came the pain, then the burn sinking in.
No tricks,
Aaron shouted at me. His anger made his aura brighter, and his human face, fragile to begin with, disappeared almost completely. Here's a little factoid. You might think you'd eventually get used to being held prisoner by the living dead, but you never do.
No tricks. Break your wrist or your leg and I'll flay you.
I stared at him from a crouch, lips skinned back, the fingers of my left hand tented on the ground. Aaron took a step away, but not because he was afraid. He did it to give himself all the room he needed to swing his fucking stick.
Do you want to come at me? Do. If you need a lesson, I'll teach you one.
I shook my head, causing my filthy hair to flop against my brow, and stood up very slowly. I was bigger and outweighed him by well over 100 pounds. He was essentially a bag of bones, but he was protected by his aura. Did I want to be electrified? I did not.
I'm sorry, I said.
And I thought for just a moment he looked surprised, as Percy had when I thanked him. He motioned me to rejoin the others.
Run!
He shouted at us.
Run, you monkeys!
Not monkeys, but another mental substitution. We circled the track. This time Hamie didn't even try, drank more power water, then were directed to the tackling dummies. Aaron stood back. One of the other night soldiers replaced him.
First one to kill his enemy gets cake. Cake for the first killer. Step forward and pick a pole.
There were 31 of us and only 12 of the tackling dummy poles. I grabbed my wrist and growled.
See how it's done first.
I was surprised by this helpful hint, but more than willing. With cake as a possible reward, 12 of my fellow prisoners quickly stepped forward and touched a burlap-wrapped pole. Among them were Eris, Fremy and Stooks, Double, and Amit.
Now, step back.
They retreated all the way to the table.
And kill your enemy.
They rushed forward. Well over half of them pulled back a little from the impact. It wasn't obvious, but I saw it. Three collided with their poles full tilt. Eris hit hard, but she was skinny, and the leering plate atop her pole only shivered. Same with the other guy who didn't flinch. His name was Murph. Amit's hit was a no-doubter. His plate flew off the top of the pole and landed 10 feet away.
"Cake for this one," Aaron proclaimed. "This one gets cake."
The watchers in the VIP box, led by the white-faced woman, cheered. Amit raised his fisted hand and bowed to them. I don't think he recognized the distinctly satiric quality of those cheers. He wasn't, as they say, the sharpest knife or the brightest bulb. The first 12 were replaced by 12 more, but I grabbed my wrist again and I stood pat. Nobody knocked a plate off this time. I, Hamie, Jaya, and I were among the last to have a go.
"Step back,"
we did.
"And kill your enemy."
I ran at my post, lowering my right shoulder, my strong side shoulder, without even thinking about it. I was pretty sure I could have hit the post hard enough to send the scowling plate head flying, even without padding, but I pulled back as I'd seen some of the others do. My plate hardly shivered at all, but Iota's came off and flew almost as far as Amit's had. This time none of the VIPs bothered cheering. They were once more lost in their own conversations. Aaron had retreated to the walkway beneath the VIP box, and there he was joined by Kellen. No smoking jacket today. The Lord High was wearing tight whipcord breeches and an open-throated white shirt beneath his aura. They walked toward us together, and I felt the same deja vu I'd felt when I saw the practice gear and the table with the drinks on it. Kellen and Aaron could have been the head coach and his assistant. This wasn't just an exercise period for the prisoners, but serious business. There was going to be a fair one, and I had an idea Kellen and Aaron were the ones responsible for making sure it was a good show.
"Sticks,"
Aaron shouted.
"Now sticks."
At that, the whole people in the box showed more interest. Even the watching night soldiers on the parapets seemed to come to attention. We went to the wicker basket containing the fighting sticks. They were like boken sticks, but without any hilts, about 3 feet long and tapered at both ends. The wood was white and smooth and hard. Ash, I thought. Like Major League Baseball bats. Kellen pointed at Eris. She stepped forward and took one of the sticks. Then he pointed at Hamie, which made my heart sink a little. He took one and held it with one hand on each tapered end. Eris had hers only by one end. Defense and offense, I thought. Neither of them looked thrilled, but only Hamie looked scared. I thought he had reason to be.
"Kill your enemy,"
Aaron shouted it, his voice buzzier than ever. Eris swung her stick. Hamie parried. She came at him from the side, and Hamie parried again, but weakly. If she had swung with real force, she didn't, she probably would have knocked him off his feet.
"Take him down,"
Kellen shrieked.
"Take him down, you useless cunt, or I'll take you down."
Eris swung low. Hamie made no effort to parry this time, and she cut the legs out from under him. He landed on the grass with a gasp and a thump. The whole people in the box cheered more lustily. Eris bowed to them. I hoped they were far enough away not to see the look of disgust on her face. Aaron whipped Hamie's butt and legs with his limber stick.
"Up! Up, you pile of dung! Up!"
Hamie struggled to his feet. Tears were rolling down his cheeks and snot hung in double runners from his nose. Aaron raised his limber stick for another slash, but Kellen stayed him with a single shake of his head. Hamie had to stay in one piece, at least until the contest commenced. Eris was kept on for another opponent. There was a lot of parrying, but no hard hits. They stepped back, and the next pair took their place. It went like that, with a lot of thrusting and swiping and parrying, but there were no more cries of take him down or kill your enemy. Stukes and Fremy, however, got whippings from one of the other night soldiers for laziness. From the way they took it, I thought it wasn't the first time. Iota went at it with Tom. Burned went at it with Bolt. And in the end, there was just me and Amit. My guess is Aaron had seen the shoulder check Amit had given me on the running track and wanted it that way. Or perhaps Kellen had seen it from wherever he'd been before coming out on the field.
"Sticks!"
Aaron shouted. God, I hated that buzzy voice.
"You two now, Sticks. Let's see how you go."
Amit held his by the end. Offense. He was smiling. I held mine by both ends, cross body, to parry. At least to start with. Amit had done this before and expected no trouble from the new kid on the block. Maybe he was right. Maybe he wasn't. We'd see.
"Kill your enemy!"
This time it was Kellen who shouted it. Amit went at me with no hesitation, rocking from side to side on his bow legs, hoping to pin me between the drinks table and the basket that held the fighting sticks, which the previous sparring partners had replaced after their contests. He raised his stick and brought it down. There was no holding back in that swing. He meant to give me a concussion or worse. Putting me away made a certain kind of sense. He might be punished, but the population of the dungeon would be back down to 30, meaning the fair one would be put off until two more whole people could be found. He might even have seen it as taking one for the team, but I didn't believe that. For whatever reason, Amit had decided he didn't like me. I dropped into a semi-crouch and raised my own fighting stick. He hit it instead of my head. I rose from my crouch, pushing his stick and driving him back. Dimly, I heard a spatter of applause from the VIP box. I stepped out from between the basket and the table, crowding him, forcing him back into the open where I could use what speed I had. That wasn't much, granted, but with those bow legs, Amit was no greyhound himself. He swung his stick first at my left side, then at my right. I parried easily now that I was in the clear. And I was angry. Very. Angry the way I'd been at Christopher Pauly when I broke one of his hands, beat him up, and then broke the other one. The way I'd been angry at my father when he retreated into booze after my mother died. I left him alone. Didn't complain about Dad's drinking, much. But I expressed that anger in other ways. Some I've told you. Some I'm too ashamed to tell. We went around in a circle on the grass, stepping and bending and fainting. The prisoners watched silently. Kellen, Aaron, and the other night soldiers were also watching. In the VIP box, the cocktail party chatter had ceased. Amit was starting to breathe hard, and he was no longer as quick with the stick. He was no longer smiling, either, and that was good.
"Come on," I said. "Come at me, you useless fuck. Let's see what you've got."
He rushed forward, raising his stick over his head. I slid one of my hands down my own stick and jammed the butt end into his belly, just above the groin. The blow he'd launched came down on my shoulder, numbing it. I didn't pull back. I dropped my stick, reached crossbody with my left hand, and snatched his away. I hit him with it, in the thigh, drew back, and hit him in the hip, really putting my own hips into the swing, as if trying to hit a line drive straight up the right field power alley. Amit screamed in pain.
"Cry off! I cry off!"
I didn't give a fuck what he cried. I swung again and hit him in the arm. He turned and began to run, but he was out of breath. Also those bow legs. I looked at Kellen, who shrugged and swept a hand at my erstwhile foe, as if to say,
"As you will."
I took it for that, anyway. I went after Amit. I could tell you I was thinking about the shoulder check, and how the whole people in the box had laughed when I went down. I could tell you I was thinking about how Jaya had tripped over me and gone sprawling. I could even tell you that I was making sure no one else would decide to mess with the new boy. None of that would have been true. None of the others had shown the slightest animus toward me, except maybe for I, and that was before he got to know me a little.
I just wanted to fuck the dude up. I hit him twice in the ass, good hard blows. The second drove him to his knees.
Cry off! Cry off! I cry off!
I raised my fighting stick over my head, but before I could bring it down, the Lord High grasped my elbow. There was that horrible feeling of being touched by a live wire and the sense that all my strength was being drained out of me. If he'd held on, I would have blacked out as I had at the outer gate. But he let go.
Enough!
My hands opened and I dropped the stick. Then I went to one knee. The VIPs were applauding and cheering. My vision was swimming, but I saw a tall guy with a scar on his cheek whispering to the white-faced woman, casually cupping one of her breasts as he did so.
Get up, Charlie.
I managed to do it. Kellen nodded at Aaron.
Playtime is over, Aaron said. Everyone take another drink.
I don't know about the rest of them, but I needed it. 3. The guards took us to one of the team rooms. It was, by the standards I was used to, large and luxurious. There were electric lights overhead, but apparently they weren't wired to the ramshackle generator and had been replaced by more gas jets. The floors and walls were white-tiled and spotless, at least until we tracked our dirt in, plus assorted splotches of blood from the stick fighting. The place was probably kept clean by gray folk, I thought, although none were in evidence now. There was a gutter of running water to piss in, which several of the men did. At either end were porcelain seats with holes in the center. I guessed those were for the women, although neither Jaya nor Eris availed themselves of them. They did strip off their tops, as the men did, and without any observable self-consciousness. Jaya had taken several fighting stick blows, her ribs were blooming with bruises. On one side of the room were wooden cubbies where team members must have once stored their gear. We, of course, had none to stow. On the other side was a long shelf lined with buckets for washing. A rag floated in each. There was no soap. I pulled off my shirt, wincing at various aches and pains, most from the blows of the limber sticks. The worst was at the small of my back. I couldn't see that one, but I could feel the blood now drying and tacky. Several people were already at the buckets, washing their upper bodies, and a few had dropped their drawers to wash the rest. I thought I might skip that part of my ablutions, but it was interesting to note that in Empis, as well as in France, at least according to the ditty, they don't wear underpants. Amit limped toward me. Our guardians hadn't come in with us, which meant there was no one to break it up if he wanted a rematch. That was okay with me. I bent, bare-chested and still caked with days of dirt, maybe weeks by then, and balled up my fists. Then, an amazing thing happened. I, Fremy, Stooks, and Hamey stood in front of me in a line, facing Amit. The bow-legged man shook his head and put the heel of his hand to his brow, as though he had a headache.
No, I didn't believe it, but I do now. Maybe I do. Are you really the...
Iota stepped forward and put a hand over Amit's mouth before he could finish. With the other hand, he pointed to a grate that might have supplied heat in the days when this stadium and the city it served had been a going concern. Amit followed his gaze and nodded. With what was obvious pain, he dropped to one knee before me and put his hand to his forehead again.
I apologize, Charlie.
I opened my mouth to say no problem, but what came out was, I accept gladly. Take your feet, Amit. They were all looking at me now, and some of the others, not Iota, not then, had also put their hands to their foreheads. They couldn't all have headaches, so it had to be a salute. They believed something that was completely ridiculous. And yet...
Wash, Charlie, Gully said.
He extended a hand to one of the buckets. For reasons I didn't understand, Eris was duck walking along the shelf and running her hands along its underside.
Go ahead. Clean yourself up.
Hair too, I said.
And when I hesitated,
it's all right. They need to see. So do I.
Then he added,
I apologize for saying that about feeding you a mouthful of dirt.
I told him no offense had been taken, not bothering to add that I'd heard plenty of trash talk in my life. It wasn't just a sports thing, it was a guy thing. I went to one of the buckets and wrung out the rag floating in it. I washed my face, neck, pits, and belly. I was very aware, excruciatingly so, that I had an audience watching me clean myself. When I'd finished everything I could reach, Jaya told me to turn around. I did so, and she washed my back. She was gentle around the slash where Aaron had hit me for skinning the cat on the rings, but I still winced.
Nana, she said.
Her voice was gentle.
Be still, Charlie. I need to get the dirt out of the woundy so don't fester up.
When she was done, she pointed at one of the buckets that hadn't been used. Then she brushed at my hair, but only for a second, before pulling back as if she'd touched something hot. I looked at Iota to be positive. He nodded. With no further ado, I grabbed the bucket and dumped it over my head. The water was cold enough to make me gasp, but it felt good. I ran my hands through my hair, getting out a load of old dirt and grit. The water that puddled around my feet was filthy. I finger-combed back as much as I could. Getting long, I thought. Probably look like a hippie. They were staring at me. All 30 of them. Some were actually gaping. All were round-eyed. I put the heel of his hand to his forehead and dropped to his knee. The others followed suit. To say I was flabbergasted doesn't cover it. Get up, I said. I'm not who you think I am. Only I wasn't sure that was true. They got to their feet. I came to me and grabbed a hank of hair that had fallen over my ear. He yanked it out, ouch, and showed me his palm. The lock of hair, even wet, shone bright in the light of the gas jets, almost as bright as Mr. Bowditch's gold pellets. What about my eyes? I asked. What color are my eyes? Iota squinted, going almost nose to nose with me.
Still hazel. But they may still be changing. You need to keep them cast down as much as you can.
The bastards like that anyway, said Stooks.
Love it,
added Fremmy.
They'll come for us any time, Eris said. Sorry, Prince Charlie, but I have to...
Don't call him that,
Tom said.
Not ever. Do you want to get him killed? Charlie, always damn Charlie.
I'm sorry, she whispered. And sorry to do this, but I have to.
She had collected a lot of black gluck from under the shelf, a mixture of old grease and dirt.
Bend to me. You're very tall.
Of course I am, I thought. Tall, Caucasian, now blonde and maybe blue-eyed all too soon. A dashing prince right out of a Disney animated feature. Not that I felt much like dashing anywhere. And the whole thing was absurd. What Disney prince had ever smeared shit on a windshield or blown up a mailbox with a cherry bomb? I bent. Very gently, she ran her fingers through my hair, dirtying it up again, darkening it. But I won't say the feel of her fingers on my scalp didn't give me a small frisson. From the way the color bloomed in Eris's cheeks, I wasn't the only one. A fist hammered on the door. One of the night soldiers shouted,
Playtime's over, get out. Hump, hump. Don't make me tell you twice, kiddies.
Eris stepped back. She looked up at me, then at I, Jaya, and Hamie.
I think he's all right,
Jaya said, low. I hoped I was. I had no desire to visit the Lord High's apartments again, or the torture chamber. If taken there, I would be urged to tell everything. And eventually, I would. Where I came from, to start with, who had helped me on my way and where they lived, then who my fellow prisoners thought I was. What I was. Their fucking savior. 4. We returned to Deep Moline. The cell doors slammed shut and locked at the outstretched arms of the night soldiers. It was a neat trick. I wondered what other ones they had. Besides administering electric jolts at will, that was. Hamie was staring at me with big eyes from his side of the cell, as far away from me as he could get. I told him to quit staring at me. It was making me nervous. He said,
I apologize, Charlie. You have to do better than that, I said. Promise me you'll try.
I promise.
And you should try doing a little better at keeping what you think you know to yourself.
I told no one what I suspected.
I looked over my shoulder and saw Fremy and Stooks side by side, staring at us from their cell, and understood how the word had gotten around. Some stories, as you probably know yourself, are just too good not to pass on. I was still inventorying my various aches and pains when the four bolts were drawn. In came Percy with a large slab of cake on a metal plate. Chocolate cake, from the look of it. My stomach cried out. He took it down the corridor to the cell Amit shared with Gully. Amit reached through the bars and pinched off a good-sized hunk. He popped it into his mouth, then said, with obvious regret,
Give the rest to Charlie. He beat me with a stick, beat me like a red-headed stepchild.
Not what he said, what I heard. Something my mother used to say after gin rummy with her friend Hedda. Sometimes Hedda beat her like a red-headed stepchild, sometimes like a rented mule, sometimes a big bass drum. There are phrases you never forget. Percy returned the way he'd come, the cake still on the plate, but with that good-sized chunk gone. Longing eyes followed it. The slice was so big that Percy had to turn the plate sideways to get it between the cell bars. I held it against the plate with my hand to keep it from falling to the floor, then licked off the frosting. My God, it was so good. I can taste it still. I started to take a bite, promising myself I'd give some to Hamie, maybe even a bit to the comedy twins next door, then hesitated. Percy was still standing in front of the cell. When he saw me looking at him, he put the heel of his poor melted hand against his gray forehead and bent his knee. 5. I slept and dreamed of Radar. She was trotting along Kingdom Road toward the supply shed where we'd spent the night before entering the city. Every now and then she stopped and looked for me, whining. Once she almost turned around to go back, but then went on. Good dog, I thought. Get safe, if you can. The moons broke through the clouds. The wolves began to howl right on cue. Radar stopped trotting and broke into a run. The howls got louder, closer. In the dream, I could see low shadows slinking to either side of Kingdom Road. The shadows had red eyes. This is where the dream turns into a nightmare, I thought, and told myself to wake up. I didn't want to see a pack of wolves, two packs, one on each side, burst from the streets and alleys of the destroyed suburbs and attack my friend. The dream thinned. I could hear Hamie groaning. Fremy and Stooks were murmuring together in the next cell. Before I could get all the way back to reality,
A wonderful thing happened. A cloud darker than the night rolled toward radar. When it flew across the racing moons, the cloud turned to lace. It was the Monarchs. They had no business flying at night. They should have been roosting, but that's dreams for you. The cloud reached my dog and hovered a few feet above her as she ran. Some actually fluttered down onto her head, back, and newly powerful haunches, their wings slowly opening and closing. The wolves stopped howling, and I woke up. Hamie was crouched over the waist hole in the corner. The rags of his pants puddled around his feet. He was clutching his belly.
"Shut it, can't you?"
I called from his side of the corridor.
"Some are trying to sleep."
"You shut it," I called back, low. I went to Hamie. "How bad is it?"
Nah, not bad."
His sweaty face said differently. Suddenly there was an explosive fart and a plop.
"Oh, gods. Better, that's better."
The stink was atrocious, but I grabbed his arm so he wouldn't fall over while he yanked up what remained of his britches.
"Oh my, who died?" Fremy asked.
"I think Hamie's asshole finally fell out," Stooks added.
"Cease," I said. "Both of you. There's nothing funny about sickness." They shut up immediately. Stooks started to put his palm to his forehead.
Nah,
I said. You pick up the lingua franca fast when you're jailed.
"Don't do that. Not ever."
I helped Hamie back to his pallet. His face was haggard and pale. The thought of him fighting anyone in a so-called fair one, even Dommy with his weak lungs, was ridiculous. No, wrong word. Horrible. Like asking a parakeet to fight a Rottweiler.
"Food don't take to me. Told you. I used to be strong, worked 12 hours a day in the Brookie sawmill. Sometimes 14 and never begged an extra rest period. Then I don't know what happened. Mushrooms? Nah, probably not. Swallowed a bad bug, most likely. Now food don't take to me. It wasn't bad at first. Now it is. Do you know what I hope?"
I shook my head.
"Hope there's a fair one, and I make it that far. Then I can die outside, and not because of my belly busts while I'm trying to take a shit in this rotten fucking cell."
"Did you get sick in here?" I thought he must have. Poisonous mushrooms either would have killed him quick, or he would have gotten better, eventually. And Deep Malene wasn't exactly an antiseptic environment. But Hamie shook his head.
"I think on the road from the Citadel. After the Grey came. Sometimes I think the Grey would have been better."
"How long ago was that?" He shook his head.
"Dunno. Years. Sometimes I think I can feel that bug buzzing around down here."
He rubbed his flabby belly.
"Buzzing around, eating me a little at a time. Taking it slow. Slow."
He armed sweat from his face.
"They were only 5 when they brought me and Jacka here."
He pointed down the corridor toward the cell Jacka shared with Burned.
"Jacka and me made 7. The number goes up. Someone dies and it goes down, but it always goes up again. Now it's 31. Bolt was here before me. He might be the longest who's still alive. And he said back then Flight Killer wanted 64. More contests that way. More blood and brains on the grass. Kellen. Must have been him. Convinced him he'd never get that many whole ones. So it's to be 32. I says if there's no 32 soon, Flight Killer will bring in Red Molly instead of saving her for the end."
This I knew.
and although I'd never seen Red Molly, I dreaded her, because I had seen her ma. But there was something I didn't know. I leaned close to Hamie.
Eldon is Flight Killer. So they call him. Does he have another name? Is he Gogmagog?
That was when I discovered the great distance, the chasm, the abyss between fairy tale magic, like sundials that turn back time, and the supernatural. Because something heard. The gas jets, which had been guttering along as usual and casting only the dimmest light, suddenly shot up in bright blue arrows that turned Deep Malene flashbulb bright. There were cries of fear and surprise from some of the cells. I saw Iota at his barred door, one hand shading his eyes. It only lasted for a second or two, but I felt the stone floor beneath me rise and then thud back. Rock dust sifted down from the ceiling. The walls groaned. It was as if our prison had cried out at the sound of that name. No, not as if. It did cry out. Then it was over. Hamie wrapped one of his thin arms around my neck, almost tight enough to choke off my air. Into my ear, he whispered,
"Don't ever say that name. Do you want to wake what sleeps in the dark well?"
Chapter 23. Tempus est umbra in mente. Hazy history. Kla. A note. Seedings. 1. When I was a freshman at Hillview, I took Latin 1. I did it because learning a dead language seemed like a cool idea, and because my dad told me that my mom took it at the same school from the same teacher, Miss Young. He said mom thought she was cool. By the time my turn came around, Miss Young, who taught French as well as Latin, was no longer young, but she was still cool. There were only 8 of us in the class, and there was no Latin 2 when I was a sophomore because Miss Young retired, and that part of the HHS language program was closed down. On our first day in class, Miss Young asked if we knew any Latin phrases. Carla Johansson raised her hand and said carpe diem, which meant seize the day. No one else was offering, so I raised my hand and gave one I'd heard from my Uncle Bob, usually when he had to get going somewhere. Tempus fugit, meaning time flies. Miss Young nodded, and when nobody else offered, she gave us some more, like ad hoc, de facto, and bona fide. When class ended, she called me back, said she remembered my mother well and was sorry I'd lost her so young. I thanked her. No tears, not after 6 years, but I got a lump in my throat.
Tempus fugit is a good one, she said. But time doesn't always fly, as everyone who's ever had to wait around for something knows. I think tempus est umbra in mente is a better one. Roughly translated, it means time is a shadow in the mind.
I thought of that often in Deep Malene. Because we were entombed, the only way to tell night from day was that in daylight, daylight somewhere, not in our durance vile, the night soldiers came less frequently. Their blue auras were reduced when they did, and their human faces became more apparent. For the most part, they were unhappy faces, tired, haggard. I wondered if these creatures had, when still human, made some sort of devil's bargain, which they regretted now that it was too late to cry it off. Maybe not Aaron and a few of the others, certainly not the Lord High. But the rest? Maybe. Or maybe I was just seeing what I wanted to see. I thought I kept a rough hold on time,
during my first week in the dungeon, but after that I lost track. I believe we were taken up to the stadium for playtime every 5 or 6 days, but for the most part, they were just practices, and not bloody. The one exception was when Yano, I'm sorry to keep throwing these names at you, but you have to remember there were 30 prisoners besides me, swung his fighting stick too hard at Eris. She ducked, he missed by a mile, and dislocated his shoulder. This did not surprise me. Yano, like the majority of my fellows, had never been what you'd call a Dwayne Johnson type to begin with, and being locked in a cell for the majority of the time hadn't exactly built him up. I exercised in my cell. Few of the others did. Another prisoner, Freed, fixed Yano's shoulder when we were returned to the team room. He told Yan to hold still, grabbed him by the elbow, and yanked. I heard the clunk as Yano's shoulder went back into place.
"That was good," I said, as we were escorted back to Malin.
Freed shrugged.
"I used to be a doctor in the Citadel many years ago."
Only years wasn't the word he used. I know I've said that before, you know I've said it before, but I need to explain, try, at least, why nothing ever quite fit in my mind. I always heard years, but when I asked questions about Empis and that word was used, it seemed to mean different things to different people. I got a picture of Empisarian history as the weeks, used advisedly, passed, but never a coherent timeline. In Dad's AA meetings, beginners were advised to take the cotton out of their ears and stick it in their mouths. "Learn to listen so you can listen to learn," they say. I sometimes asked questions, but mostly I kept my ears open and my mouth shut. They talked because there was little else to do. They argued about when thus and such had happened, or if it had happened at all. They told stories their parents and grandparents had told them. A picture began to form, hazy, but better than no picture at all. Once upon a time, long ago, the monarchy had been a real monarchy with a real army, for all I know, even a navy. Sort of like England was, I suppose, in the days of James, Charles, and the Henry with all the wives. These Empis kings of yore, I can't say if there was ever a queen in charge, that's one of many things I don't know, were supposedly chosen by the high gods. Their rule was unquestioned. They were almost considered to be gods themselves, and for all I knew, they were. Is it so hard to believe that kings and maybe members of their family could levitate, strike enemies dead with a cross look, or heal sickness by touching in a land where there were mermaids and giants? At some point, the Galleons became the ruling family. According to my fellow prisoners, that was, you guessed it, many years ago. But as time passed, I'm guessing maybe 5 or 6 generations, the Galleons began to loosen the royal grip. In the time leading up to the Grey, Empis was a monarchy in name only. The royal family's still a big deal, but no longer the be-all and end-all. Take the Citadel. Doc Freed told me it was run by a council of 7, and the councillors were elected. He spoke of the Citadel as if it were this big, important city, but the picture I got was of a small and wealthy town that prospered on trade between Seafront and Lillimar. Maybe other towns or principalities like Deesk and Ullum, at least before Ullum went all gaga religious, were about the same, each with its own specialty, the inhabitants of each just going about their business. The prisoners, most of whom became my friends, complicated by their belief that I was or might be some magical prince, knew only a little of Lillimar and the palace, not because it was a big secret, but because they had their own lives and towns to take care of. They paid tribute to King Jan, Double actually thought he was King Jam, like something you'd spread on bread, because the amounts demanded were reasonable, and because the army, much reduced by then and renamed the King's Guard, kept up the roads and bridges. Tribute also paid for some fellows Tom called the Riding Sheriffs and Amit called the Possemen. These were the words I heard. The people of Empis also paid tribute because Jan was, ta-da, the king, and because folks tend to do what tradition demands. They probably bitched a little, the way people always do about paying taxes, then forgot all about it until the Empisarian equivalent of April 15th came around again. What about the magic, you ask? The sundial, the night soldiers, the buildings that sometimes seem to change their shapes? They took it for granted. If you find that strange, imagine a time traveler from 1910 being transported to 2010 and finding a world where people flew through the sky in giant metal birds and rode in cars capable of going 90 miles an hour. A world where everyone went bopping around with powerful computers in their pockets. Or imagine a guy who's only seen a few silent black and white films plunked down in the front row of an IMAX theater and watching Avatar in 3D. You get used to the amazing, that's all. Mermaids and IMAX, giants and cell phones. If it's in your world, you go with it. It's wonderful, right? Only look at it another way, and it's sort of awful. Think Gogmagog is scary? Our world is sitting on a potentially world-ending supply of nuclear weapons. And if that's not black magic, I don't know what is. 2. In Empis, kings came and went. For all I knew, the preserved bodies of the galleons were kept in one of those huge gray buildings Radar and I had passed as we followed Mr. Bowditch's initials to the sundial. King Jan was anointed with the usual rituals. Bolt claimed a sacred cup made of gold was involved. Jacka insisted that Jan's wife was Queen Clara, or maybe Kara, but most of the others insisted she had been Cora, and that she and Jan were third cousins or something. None of my fellows seemed to know how many children they'd had. Some said 4, some said 8, and Amit swore there were 10.
Those two must have fucked like royal rabbits, he said.
According to what I knew from a certain princess's horse, they were all wrong. There had been 7, 5 girls and 2 boys. And this is where the story got interesting to me. You could even say relevant, although it remained maddeningly hazy. King Jan fell ill. His son Robert, who'd always been the favored one, as well as the older of the 2 boys, waited in the wings, ready to drink from the sacred cup. I imagined engraved butterflies around the rim. Eldon, the younger brother, was pretty well forgotten, except by Leah, that was, who idolized him.
By all accounts, he was an ugly, limping fuck,
Dommy said one night.
Not one clubfoot, but both of them.
Wardy, too, I heard, Akka said.
Hump on his back,
Fremy said.
Heard it was a lump on his neck,
Stook said. It was interesting to me, even illuminating, that they talked about Eldon, the ugly, limping, nearly forgotten prince, and the flight killer as 2 different people. Or like a caterpillar that morphs into a butterfly. At least part of the King's Guard had also morphed, I believed, into the night soldiers. Eldon was jealous of his brother, and jealousy grew into hatred. All of them seemed to agree on this point, and why not? It was a classic story of sibling rivalry that would have been at home in any fairy tale. I knew good stories are not always true stories, or not completely true, but this one was plausible enough, human nature being what it is. Eldon decided to take the kingship, either by force or by guile, and be revenged on his family. If Empis as a whole also suffered, so be it. Did the Grey come before or after Eldon became the flight killer? Some of my fellows said before, but I think it was after. I think he brought it somehow. One thing I'm sure of is how he got his new name.
The butterflies were everywhere in Empis,
Dockfried said.
They darkened the skies.
This was after the practice when he yanked Yano's shoulder back in place. We were returning to our dungeon keep, walking side by side. Doc was speaking low, almost whispering. It was easier to talk going down the stairs, and the pace was slow because we were tired out.
What he said made me think of how passenger pigeons had once darkened the skies of the Midwest. Until they were hunted out of existence, that was. Only who would hunt monarch butterflies? Were they good to eat? I asked. That was, after all, why the passenger pigeons went bye-bye. They were cheap food on the wing. He snorted.
Monarchs are poisonous, Charlie. Eat one, you might only get an upset stomach. Eat a handful, and you could die. They were everywhere, as I say, but they were especially thick in Lillimar and the suburbs that surround it.
Did he say suburbs or smallies? It came to the same thing.
People grew milkweed in their gardens for the larvae to eat, and flowers for the butterflies to drink nectar from when they emerged. They were considered the luck of the kingdom.
I thought of all the defaced statues I'd seen, spread wings hammered to rubble.
The story goes that once Eldon's family was killed, and only he was left. He walked through the streets in a red robe with a snowy ermine collar, the golden crown of the galleons on his head. The skies were dark with monarchs, as was typical, but each time Eldon raised his hands, thousands fell dead from the skies. When the people fled the city, a few stayed, paid homage, swore allegiance. They ran through drifts of dead butterflies. It's said that inside the city wall, those drifts were 10 feet deep. Millions of dead monarchs, with their bright colors fading to gray.
That's awful, I said. We were almost back by then.
Do you believe it? I know they also died in the Citadel. I saw them dropping out of the skies myself. Others will tell you the same.
He brushed at his eyes, then looked up at me.
I'd give a deal to see a butterfly while we're out on that playing field. Just one. But I suppose they're all gone.
No, I said.
I've seen them. A lot of them.
He took my arm, his grip surprisingly strong for a little man. Although if the fair one came, I didn't think the dock would last much longer than Hamie.
Is that the truth? Do you swear it?
Yes.
On your mother's name now.
One of our guards looked back, frowning, and made a threatening gesture with his limber stick before facing forward again.
On my mother's name,
I said, keeping it low. The monarchs weren't gone, and neither were the galleons. Not all, at least. They had been cursed by whatever power now lived in Eldon, the same power that had reduced the closer suburbs to rubble, I assumed, but they were alive. I didn't tell Freed that, though. It might have been dangerous for both of us. I thought of Woody's story about Hannah chasing the remains of his family to the city gates, and how she had swatted off the head of Woody's nephew, Aloysius.
When did Hannah come? Why did she come, if the giants live in the north?
He shook his head.
I don't know.
I thought that perhaps Hannah had been on a visit to the home folks in Cratchy when Mr. Bowditch made his last gold-getting expedition, but there was no way to tell. He was dead, and as I say, Empisarian history was hazy. That night I lay awake a long time. I wasn't thinking about Empis, or the butterflies, or the flight killer. I was thinking about my father. Missing him, and worrying about him. For all I knew, he might think I was as dead as my mother. 3. Time slipped away, unmarked and uncounted. I gathered my little crumbs of information, although for what purpose, I wasn't sure. Then, one day, we came back from a practice slightly more arduous than the others had been lately, to find a bearded man, a lot bigger than either me, Dommy, or Iota, in Iota's cell. He was dressed in muddy short pants and an equally muddy striped shirt, the sleeves cut off to show slabs of muscle.
He was squatting on his hunkers in the corner, knees up around his ears, as far from the blue presence also occupying the cell as he could get, the blue presence being the Lord High. Kellen held up one hand. The gesture was almost lackadaisical, but the pair of night soldiers leading us stopped at once and stood at attention. We all stopped. Jaya was beside me that day, and her hand crept into mine. It was very cold. Kellen stepped out of Ai's cell and looked us over.
My dear friends, I would like you to meet your new compatriot. His name is Kla. He was found on the shore of Lake Remla after his little boat sprang a leak. He nearly drowned, didn't you, Kla?
Kla said nothing, only looked at Kellen.
Answer me!
Yes, I almost drowned.
Try again. Address me as Lord High.
Yes, Lord High. I almost drowned.
Kellen turned back to us.
But he was rescued, my dear friends, and, as I'm sure you can see, there is not a bloom of grey anywhere on him. Just dirt.
Kellen tittered. It was an awful sound. Jaya's hand tightened on mine.
Introductions aren't common in Deep Malene, as you no doubt know. But I felt my new dear friend Kla warranted one, because he is our 32nd guest. Isn't that wonderful?
No one said anything. Kellen pointed at one of the night soldiers at the head of our unlucky procession, then at Bernd, who was in front beside Amit. The night soldier hit Bernd in the neck with his stick. Bernd screamed, went to his knees, and clapped his hand over an ooze of blood. Kellen bent toward him.
What is your name? I won't apologize for having forgotten. There are so many of you.
Bernd,
he choked.
Bernd of the
Citadel. No such place as the Citadel,
Kellen said.
Not now, and not ever again. Just Bernd will do. So tell me, Bernd of nowhere at all. Is it wonderful that King Eldon, the Flight Killer, now has 32? Answer up, loud and proud.
Yes,
Bernd said. Blood dripped between his clutching fingers.
Yes, what?
And then, as if teaching a small child to read.
One, loud and proud now.
Wonderful,
Bernd said, looking down at the wet stones of the corridor.
Woman,
Kellen said.
You, Erin. Is it Erin?
Yes, Lord High,
Eris said. No way was she going to correct him.
Is it wonderful that Kla has joined us?
Yes, Lord High.
How wonderful.
Very wonderful, Lord High.
Is it your cunt that stinks, or your asshole, Erin?
Eris's face was a blank, but her eyes were on fire. She lowered them, which was wise.
Probably both, Lord High.
Yes, I think both. You now, Iota. Step to me.
I stepped forward, almost to the protective blaze of blue surrounding Kellen.
Are you happy to have a cellmate?
Yes, Lord High.
Is it one?
Kellen flapped one white hand, and I realized he was happy. No, not just happy. Over the moon. Or, considering where we were, moons. And why not? He'd been set a gathering task, and it was now complete. I also realized how much I hated him. I also hated the flight killer, sight unseen.
Wonderful.
Kellen slowly reached toward Iota, who tried to stand his ground but flinched back when the hand was less than an inch from his face. I heard the air crackle and saw Ai's hair stir in response to whatever force was keeping Kellen alive.
Wonderful what, Iota?
Wonderful, Lord High.
Kellen had had his fun. He strode through us impatiently. We tried to get away, but some weren't fast enough and got walloped by his aura. They went to their knees, some silent, some whimpering in pain. I pushed Jaya out of his way, but my arm entered the blue envelope around him, and scalding pain ran up to my shoulder, locking all of the muscles. It was 2 long minutes before they loosened.
They should let the gray slaves go free and run their old generator on that power, I thought.
At the door, Kellen spun to face us, finishing with a stamp of his foot, like a Prussian drill instructor.
Listen to me, dear friends. Barring a few exiles who don't matter, and a few fugitive whole people who may have scarpered in the early days of Flight Killer's reign, you are the last of the royal blood, the watered-down spawn of rakes, rascals, and rapists. You will serve at Flight Killer's pleasure, and you will serve soon. Playtime is over. The next time you step on the field of Elden, formerly the field of the Monarchs, it will be for the first round of the Fair One.